Nomoto presents American presidents. Arthur St. Clair, President of Congress, 1787. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 28 minutes. Arthur St. Clair's year in the chair feels like a hinge cut out of iron, heavy, cold to the touch, load-bearing in a way that is easy to miss if you only glance at the door it is holding up. In February 1787, he took his seat as President of the United States in Congress assembled at a moment when the Confederation government had very nearly taught the country to stop expecting anything from it. The Treasury was a rumor. Requisitions sounded princely and worked like charity. British garrisons still sat in the old Northwest as if the treaty that ended the war were a weather report. Spain toyed with the Mississippi as if it were a faucet at the end of its corridor. States taxed one another as if borders were levies against neighbors rather than seams of a single cloth. And in the hills west of Boston, men who had marched for liberty were now marching court to keep sheriffs from selling their farms for debt. Into that thin air stepped a compact Scotsman with an old soldier's bearing and a clerk's appetite for exact forms. He had come to America as a British officer, laid down the King's Commission in peacetime, become a Pennsylvania magistrate, then taken up arms for a different flag, and carried the cost and reputation when Ticonderoga fell from his hands. He had learned to do two hard things very well, read a map and absorb blame. The first skill made him useful in a Congress that had to imagine a continental future on paper before it could exist on the ground. The second kept his head steady when a national frame creaked so loudly that lesser men mistook the sound for doom. He began far from Philadelphia's drafty chambers, in the far north of Scotland, by the Pentland Firth's gray churn, where the wind teaches a boy that pride is a poor cloak. Arthur St. Clair was born to modest gentry in 1737 and sent south to learn medicine under William Hunter in London, an apprenticeship that taught him anatomy and patience, but did not cure him of a soldier's curiosity. He exchanged the dissecting theater for a commission in the British Army and sailed for the New World to fight in the Seven Years' War. He saw the St. Lawrence from the deck of a transport and the Plains of Abraham from the ground, a young subaltern staring at a city under a sky that made ambition look smaller than winter. Those campaigns gave him something grander than a story to tell in old age. They gave him the habit of coordination, boats that must be at the right bend at the right hour, wagons that must arrive before the powder is damp, the way a line on a map can become a bloodline if you misread the contour of a hill. When the King's peace came, he resigned his commission and stayed, marrying into Pennsylvania property and learning that civil authority requires a different sort of discipline than drill, the patience to listen to neighbors, the care to write their disputes down in words that make tomorrow possible when today is over. The imperial quarrel did not make him a pamphleteer. He did not write about sovereignty. He staged it. He organized militia, kept powder dry, and took the field. In the war's early spirals, he proved the sort of officer a new republic breeds when it is lucky. Not a peacock and not a coward, flexible with small units and stubborn about duty. He was with Washington in the hard winter games that make historians write sentences flavored with inevitability and veterans remember only mud and hunger. Then came 1777 and the long shadow of a fortress on Lake Champlain. Ticonderoga, the outpost that had changed hands with fanfare earlier in the war, sat under British pressure while St. Clair looked at his magazines, his returns, his odds, and his responsibility. He evacuated rather than lose the garrison and the guns, a decision that was right by arithmetic and wrong by public appetite. The country, inflamed by print, wanted a spectacular stand. He gave it a living army and a retreat. The British gave their newspapers a flag on a bastion. Congress gave him suspicion. He asked for a court-martial and received one, stood under oath, and was acquitted. The verdict repaired the law, not the scar. Washington understood. He always did. Much of the country did not, and the name St. Clair began to carry the metallic taste of controversy whenever it came near a map. The war ended, as wars sometimes do, with a suddenness that leaves the mechanics of peace looking improvised. St. Clair moved between the Army's disbanding tents and Pennsylvania's hard benches, kept his temper in rooms where men confused victory with solvency, and learned how much of a nation's honor resides in its ledgers. When Congress chose presidents of its own body, it did not look for kings without crowns. It looked for men who could sit a long morning and keep the agenda from dissolving into grievances. In February 1787, it turned to St. Clair, partly for his steadiness, partly for his geography. He could read the West in his sleep. He could translate between surveyors' chains and statutes. And Congress, whether it knew it or not, was about to do its best work in a generation by writing a law that turned vastness into a plan without turning that plan into a plantation. He took the chair in a city where national politics still smelled of wagon grease and candle smoke. The presidency of Congress was not the presidency that the country would later invent. It had no cabinet, no independent officers, no veto to swing like a cudgel, no army to send, no purse to open. It had letters to sign, minutes to polish, visitors to receive, and the thankless art of turning many wills into a sentence that read as if it had always been obvious. St. Clair's first tests were not ceremonial. They were structural. The Annapolis Convention of the previous fall, thinly attended, bracingly frank, had concluded that trade barriers between the states were the visible symptoms of a deeper disease. The Articles of Confederation could not supply energy to a republic of continental scale. It recommended that the states send delegates to a general convention in Philadelphia in May to revise the frame. That recommendation needed congressional blessing if the Philadelphia meeting was to be anything more than a conclave of reformers. On February 21, 1787, under St. Clair's gavel, Congress resolved to recommend such a convention for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. The words were legal gauze, designed to dress a surgery that would soon be radical. But without the gauze, the operation might never have reached the theater. St. Clair was not a framer in the high sense. He did not sit behind the green baize that summer with Washington presiding. He was the man who steered the old body through the narrow gate that made the new one possible without tearing the old one to pieces in public. Even as he signed that permission slip, the evidence of the article's insufficiency piled on his desk. From London came polite letters attached to impolite behavior. British officers still in possession of frontier posts at Niagara, Detroit, and elsewhere, explaining that the United States might find the key under the doormat once American states ceased to mistreat creditors and loyalists. From New Orleans came Spanish compliments edged with the quiet assertion that the Mississippi was a Spanish river at a Spanish mouth and would open or close with a Spanish hand. From every harbor came complaints that neighbors had discovered the pleasure of raising imposts against one another while refusing to grant Congress the narrow impost that would have given the Union the dignity of a predictable income. From the Connecticut Valley came the ache of Shays country, taxes that felt like a punishment for having fought, courts that sounded like a foreign language when they said execution and meant a farm at auction, crowds that told themselves they were protecting liberty by disabling law. St. Clair could not solve those problems. No president of Congress could. He could keep the record straight, keep the language clean, keep the institution from sounding like a gathering of men who had forgotten the difference between a meeting and a complaint. The way he wrote is as important as anything he signed. He answered foreign ministers in sentences that admitted difficulty without confessing impotence, the mature tone of a republic that wished to be treated as adult even when its pockets were empty. He acknowledged to the states that a national impost would be an intrusion and a salvation, and he did it without scolding, as if he trusted the reader's conscience as much as he distrusted the reader's next election. He forwarded intelligence about disturbances and potential mutinies without theatrics, because panic is an accelerant, and insisted, in the face of the year's temptations, that Congress perform the rituals that turn a people into a nation, open on time, refer business to committees with deadlines, receive reports, take votes, send letters the day they are dated. Under a government that had no means to compel, tempo was authority. He kept the time. The great act of his presidency arrived in July like a map unrolled on a long table. For years, Congress had been stumbling toward a coherent policy for the Western country north of the Ohio River. Jefferson's Ordinance of 1784 had drawn an elegant ladder of stages toward self-government and equality within the Union, even daring, by a failing single vote, to bar slavery from the territory after 1800. The Land Ordinance of 1785 had traced a grid over the wilderness, townships 6 miles square, sections of 640 acres, one reserved for schools, so that speculation might be somewhat tamed by survey and property might be made legible to courts before it became irresistible to rifles. What remained was a civil constitution for that space. Rights articulated, offices arranged, a path to statehood that was not caprice, and a statement, rare in the world, that the people who moved into that space would carry with them a charter of liberties that did not depend on the whim of a distant prince or a local oligarchy. On July 13, 1787, Congress adopted the Northwest Ordinance. St. Clair presided and signed. There is no point in pretending the ordinance solved the moral geometry of a frontier where native nations still lived by their own law and where white hunger for land was a force of nature as relentless as any river. It did something else, something both admirable and limited. It set out a Bill of Rights for the territory, religious freedom, the benefit of habeas corpus, trial by jury, proportionate representation, encouragement of schools and education because religion, morality, and knowledge were declared necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind. It promised that the new states would enter the Union on equal footing with the old, not as provinces or dependencies. And it forbade slavery in the territory, while embedding the fugitive clause that made human beings into property again if they crossed the wrong line. The ordinance was a scaffolding, not a cathedral. Its best pages read like the minutes of a people teaching itself to be decent. It's worse like the warranty on a machine that would hum until it met the first real stress. It is not a stretch to say that without that law, the American Republic would have drifted westward as a set of baronies and land companies, all teeth and no tongue. St. Clair did not write the ordinance's poetry. He made sure its prose became law. He managed the debate that glued rights to administration, soothed fears that an anti-slavery clause would tear the Union, and insisted that the act not read like a pious wish, but like an instrument ready for use. Within weeks, Congress appointed him governor of the Northwest Territory. It was not an act of patronage alone. It was the practical recognition that the paper he had midwifed would need a magistrate who could think in both directions at once, forward estates that did not yet exist, back to a Congress that did not have the power to rescue a governor who mistook a rifle for a writ. The appointment sundered the neatness of his presidency's storyline. He was now both the man who certified the law and the officer who would have to live within its contradictions. He left the chair later that year with a map in his pocket, and a future full of edges. To understand the clarity he brought to that moment and the limits he could not erase, you have to watch him with two lenses at once. In the National Chamber, he was the embodiment of restraint, the veteran who understood that institutions acquire dignity by performing it. He handled the perfumed treacheries of diplomacy without taking offense, careful to translate the insults of foreign policy into little more than evidence. He kept the American habit of hyperbole out of official letters, resisting the urge to call every indignity a catastrophe and thereby preserving the capacity to name a real one when it came. He presided over the congressional transmit of the Philadelphia Convention's work, received the Constitution that summer when Washington and the rest finished with their heat and their compromises, sent it to the states with a formal envelope rather than a sermon, and kept Congress from either embracing it with a desperation that would have made doubters smell fear or resisting it in a way that would have made ratification look like insubordination. He behaved like a caretaker of an old house in the hour before a renovation. He kept the roof from leaking until the carpenters arrived. In the Western country that would soon be his responsibility, the ordinance's squares were haunted from the day the first stake went in. Treaties like Fort Stanwix and Fort McIntosh had told themselves stories about sessions that made sense to the people who drafted them and far less sense to the people who were said to have ceded. St. Clair knew it. He was neither cynic nor naive. He believed in negotiation because he believed in law, and he believed in militia because he had seen what happens when negotiation breaks on the facts of hunger, fear, and rumor. The governor he became the next year would try to make academic words, sovereignty, jurisdiction, peace, live on a road where farmers cursed surveyors and chiefs counted knights before the next delegation arrived. That later story darkened with a defeat of such brutality in 1791 that it still shakes the mind when you let the numbers in. But in 1787, he was still the presiding officer who had given the country its finest plan for turning land into a common future. If his presidency amounted only to those two flares, endorsement of the Philadelphia meeting and adoption of the Northwest Ordinance, it would be enough to reserve him a careful seat in our civic memory. But there was a daily labor too, the kind that never makes schoolbooks because it produces no climaxes, only continuity. He kept Congress sitting. That sentence looks simple until you consider what it means to keep quorum in a government built to make inaction virtuous. Delegates summoned home by jealous assemblies, roads that swallow a fortnight for a winter trip, taverns that make resolution slow, a treasury too clumsy to reimburse travel without a four-page dance. He wrote personal notes that nudged rather than scolded. He paced the agenda so that the most essential business landed when the benches were fullest. He avoided the sentimental error of believing that eloquence is an accomplishment. He pursued instead the plainer craft of turning a paper into an order and an order into a habit. The Articles had designed a talking legislature. He tried to teach it to act with a whisper of executive timing. The tone he set mattered in another way. The Confederation period is often remembered as a melancholy of shortfalls and insults, a bridge sagging between war and a new constitution that the country proved wise enough to build. Melancholy is accurate. Sagging is not the whole story. The United States under the Articles taught itself rhythms of public life that later institutions would depend upon more than they would admit. It learned that a national letter written on a Wednesday and answered on a Monday is a kind of promise kept. It learned that you can transmit controversy without inflaming it and watch a better decision be possible next week for having not been pressed this week. It learned that you treat allies and enemies with equal courtesy in the mail because letters are also arguments about your own legitimacy. St. Clair was a teacher of such lessons. He was not a genius of theory. He was a connoisseur of forms. In a frail year, that was the kind of genius the country needed. None of this erases the shadows that would later fall across his name. After his year in Congress, he crossed the Ohio as governor and then called again to military duty because the line between civil and military necessity was thin in that place and that hour. He led a column north in 1791 to lay out forts and insist upon the United States in the only language it believed remained. What happened then has a name of its own, St. Clair's defeat, and figures that belong in the pit of the stomach. Hundreds of soldiers and camp followers cut down in the woods by a confederacy of native warriors led with skill and nerve, a surprise converted into a rout, a morning of smoke that peeled away the lacquer of inevitability from the new republic's westward dreams. He resigned his commission, ordered a court of inquiry, lived through the ritual of disgrace once more. He was again cleared of cowardice and convicted by posterity of having presided over a catastrophe. He spent his last years in Pennsylvania, poor as only an honest official can die, his legacy a ledger written in ambiguities, governor and general, planner and loser, presiding officer and defeated commander. If you return to 1787 and you hold those later facts in mind, the year under his gavel feels even more exact. He knew already what it meant to bear failure that was not solely your own. He knew what it meant to be judged by men who had never marched a mile. He knew the difference between a blunder and a hard arithmetic, and he did not confuse them. That knowledge freed him to do his work without bending the narrative to make himself look handsome. He had no need to preen over the Northwest Ordinance in the minutes. He did not pad Congress's endorsement of the Philadelphia Convention with self-congratulations. He behaved as if the dignity of those acts would live in the acts themselves and not in the adjectives attached to them. He was right. The ordinance's grid still lies across the continent, a beauty and a violence both. The constitutional resolution still reads like a clean hinge in the national minutes. His name does not dominate either document's subsequent fame. It does not have to. He was not in the business of names. There is a small human scene that helps fix him in place. Imagine the New York chamber in late winter, the windows leaking a little, the harbor masts beyond like black punctuation. He enters not like a general inspected by a line, but like a chairman who will make the room behave like a body. He confers with a secretary, asks after attendance, touches the day's docket, which is never as short as it looks. He begins on time. The letters are read, not all aloud, not all in full. Efficiency is not a sin. A delegate attempts to widen a narrow question into a lantern for his party's program back home. St. Clair smiles at the right second, calls the next item. A memorial from frontier settlers asks for relief from a border drawn in a platted dream. He refers it to the proper committee and sets a day for report. A packet from the commissioners of the Board of Treasury contains arithmetic that will not cheer anyone but must still be sent to 13 legislatures with a tone that does not invite indifference. He writes, quietly, that honor has its price. In the afternoon, the talk turns to the proposed convention in Philadelphia, and he guides the language that will both contain and enable it, a sentence that satisfies anxieties by appearing to restrain what everyone in the room suspects cannot be restrained. He adjourns at an hour that allows for the business to be written down before the candles gutter. He leaves with a soldier's step and a bookman's expression. It does not look like glory. It looks like survival made orderly. What, then, did he fail to do? He did not give Congress income. He could not. He did not unbolt British forts with an essay. He could not. He did not persuade Spain to love the Mississippi's American future. He could not. He did not conjure unanimity for the impost. The articles had turned unanimity into a permanent veto for those who found virtue in delay. He did not pacify the Western country by parchment. No one could. He did not make the Philadelphia Convention inevitable. He merely made it respectable. Those admissions are not a bill of indictment. They are the territory's map. Inside that map, he accomplished what the year required. He kept the old frame dignified while it gave birth to a new one. He saw a law through that made the West a promise instead of a scramble. He made letters instruments rather than apologies. He turned a meeting into a government as far as the articles allowed, and he did not pretend that farther was possible. He belongs, finally, in a short list of men whose usefulness is easier to feel than to praise. Washington gave the Republic its posture, Hamilton its appetite, Madison its logic, Jefferson its lyric about equality that came with the prose about property. St. Clair gave it the comfort of correct minutes in a desperate year and the solid click of a statute whose consequences would outlast his own reputation. He is not the hero of any schoolchild's pageant. He is the signature under one of the most consequential enactments in our early law and the calm chair behind a resolution that opened a door through which an entirely new polity walked. If you stand a while with his year, something else comes into focus. The way the Confederation Congress, so often caricatured as a debating society in which men scolded the absent and congratulated the present, could, in the hands of a disciplined presiding officer, behave like the custodian of a national conscience. The Northwest Ordinance's Bill of Rights was not merely aspirational. It was a declaration that even in a place where property was the magnet and distance the rule, certain decencies would be insisted upon. The anti-slavery clause was not an abolition. It was a line across which slavery would not be spread under national authority. That line would become one of the stitches in the country's future quarrels, a seam that later generations would try to close or tear with murder. In 1787, it was also a statement about what Congress believed it could ask of Americans moving into a new space. St. Clair's Congress asked it. He made the asking sound like law. He left the chair in November, handed the gavel to Cyrus Griffin, and turned west with his commission in his pocket. It is uncomfortable to tell the truth about what followed because it sharpens the paradox inside his legacy. His governance of the territory mixed literacy with inevitability. He established courts, insisted upon schools, parceled land according to the grid he had fathered, and tried to keep speculation from devouring equity. He also inhabited the century's orthodoxy about native power to be respected in diplomacy, to be resisted in war. When diplomacy faltered and war came, he let a column into the trees with too little preparation, too much assumption, and command arrangements that cracked like a stale loaf in the first heat. The defeat that bears his name does not cancel his year in Congress. It complicates it. It reminds us that the men who wrote and signed our better pages were, sometimes within the same decade, the authors of pages that we must read with our teeth set. It insists that we not turn biography into comfort, but return him, for judgment, to the winter and summer of 1787. There he is at his best, a man who had known command enough to distrust swagger, who had known blame enough to be careful with it, who had learned to see public business not as an opportunity for display, but as a calling that requires a tolerance for boredom. He did not feel the need to be the center of the story, to be essential to it. He did not confuse speed with haste. He did not mistake decorum for paralysis. He used decorum to make motion possible without breaking the fragile thing under his hand. And when the time came for the old frame to hand the future to a new one, he did not cling out of wounded pride. He signed what needed to be signed, transmitted what needed to be transmitted, and went where the Republic sent him next. If you need, at the end, a single sentence to hang his presidency on, try this. In a government that could barely act, he made action credible. In a year when the West could have become a series of private empires, he helped make it a Commonwealth in waiting. In a month when the country needed the old Congress to bless the birth of a new constitution without sounding desperate or resentful, he found the tone and held it. That is not the sort of achievement that fills parades. It is the sort that fills the long quiet in which nations actually live.